tiny bubbles airline. Make me happy, make me feel fine. Tiny bubbles make me warm all over. Well, the feeling that I'm gonna love you till the end of time. So here's to the golden moon, and here's to the silver sea, and mostly here's a toast to you and me. Tiny bubbles,
tiny bubbles
in the wine,
in the wine.
Make me happy,
make me happy.
Make me feel fine,
make me feel fine.
Tiny bubbles,
tiny bubbles,
make me warm all
Hi, Renee?
Yeah?
It's Robin from the Inkstead.
Hi, Robin.
We hooked up.
All right.
Yay.
Was it really difficult?
I ended up having to get operator assistance when I dialed the number.
It's too many numbers.
They tossed me through into talking to someone. The person was not very happy to talk to me.
So my directions were not correct?
No, your directions were probably correct. I used a phone card, so...
Oh, oh.
So, and it said...
That's a lot more numbers.
Yeah, and it said 201 for an international, and I did that, and then I dialed the whole directions you gave me, and then, yeah. But we're here. So I'm sitting here with another Robin. Her name's Robin K. I'll be Robin M.
Hello.
Hello, Renee.
We're both fans of your work, and both...
There are a lot of Robins up there.
There are a total of... Used to be five of us. Now it's down to four because one's just moved to Montreal. All in one town.
It's a really popular name.
I don't know what it is with parents.
You're not all related, though, right?
No.
Only through our love of comics.
That's very much true.
That's
so
good.
We'll start out by talking about your latest work, The Ticking.
Okay.
From Top Shelf. That came out last year, was it? Or this year?
It just came out in April.
In April. Okay. I'm not on the ball, am I?
So off the ball.
A creepy tale of a young man's journey into, I don't know, adulthood, adolescence near the end?
I'd say early adulthood, I guess.
Okay. A bridge between adulthood and adolescence.
I actually found it to be kind of less creepy, have a lower creepy factor than a lot of your other work.
Yeah, I was just going to say, did you find it really creepy, Robin A? Robin 1?
I'll go with that, Robin 1. I found it... I find the disfigurement creepy, the story itself more just sad.
Yeah, right, okay.
It strikes me as a young boy happy with who he is, but his dad isn't happy with who he is and who his dad is. His dad isn't happy with himself, and he sees that in his son, and he doesn't see that happiness, you know. Did
absolutely.
I get the right thing?
Yes. I mean, I and Robin, too, you're saying it's less creepy, but I'm glad you said that, because I kind of, to me, it doesn't seem creepy. It's really, and a friend of mine actually has a, you know, 10-year-old who loves it. And I hadn't thought of it for kids at all, but this little girl really loves the book because, and I don't think the creepiness really comes through for her. The deformity isn't as creepy for her, I think, as maybe for adults. I don't know, but yeah, I mean, a lot of it is about the self-hatred of the father, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I thought maybe your little girlfriend, probably it comes through how the main character, the Edison Steelhead, like his own self-love and his sense of self-worth, although I couldn't really understand like how, where he got that, because he's living in such an isolated condition, living on that little island with the lighthouse on it, right?
I was sort of playing with the idea of could someone in an isolated environment like that, just from, you know, I mean, could someone be turn out okay if they're all, the only person that they're exposed to is someone who doesn't approve of them? And I have to think that it's possible. I have to think it's possible. It's it's too depressing to think that it's not, because I know there are a lot of people who grow up in, you know, homes that are just really repressive and violent and abusive and turn out okay. I know they have other support, but sometimes they don't, you know. And I think there are cases where people turn out okay in that kind of situation.
It almost sounds to me like unintentionally you have, in a way, done a kid's book with this one, because there is, you know, the moral at the end of the story is that, you know, pride in yourself, I guess.
Yeah, I know. I'm kind of fighting myself right now, fighting this kid's book thing right now. Because I've been doing these mainstream kids books for Simon & Schuster and picture books, and having a hard time with it because of all of the editorial input and having to fight my little battles with the editors and having this sort of anger for the kids book. Even it's under the surface for me, but you know, in a way, it's a really great experience. But on the other hand, it's kind of frustrating for me. So, the fact that this thing that was for adults turned out to be sort of like a kid's book, not like a mainstream kid's book, is kind of interesting in a way for me. I mean, it's turned out that way. A couple kids, you know, it's not only this one little girl. A couple kids have actually said, you know, that they really liked it. So.
Well, I think that,
and a lot of kids were coming up at San Diego. A lot of kids were coming up to the table and picking it up and looking at it and liking the pictures and the bugs and everything.
Well, the drawings are really appealing, and all the masks that he has to put on, like the monkey mask and stuff, are really cute. they like that.
Yep.
It's more of an all-ages book, really, isn't it? You know, because adults, like, can appreciate it on a different level.
Yeah.
What was the creative process for putting The Ticking together?
It was insane and stupid. I decided that that it would be a really good idea to work on individual little pieces of paper. Because I used to do that a really long time ago, when I was doing grid baths for Fantagraphics, I used to work on like individual little pieces of paper and then glue them together. I think Chester Brown did that for a while, or at least he would draw his pages in his comics. He would draw his pages as a page with little pieces taped on top of it, mm-hmm. and then so he could sort of take one out or put one on, you know, shuffle them around and stuff. And I used to work like that, but I didn't actually have that much stuff back then, or I didn't. It wasn't a huge story. There would be these short stories. Well, this one was there were just so many little panels for this book that in the end, when I needed to put it together, it was just insane, because I was, what I was doing was mounting them on, or just taping them to a piece of paper and then scanning them individually, scanning the pages, and then cleaning up the cut lines and everything on the scans, instead of just cleaning up, say, pencil marks or something. So it seemed like a good idea at the time, but I don't think I'd do it again that way. But you're talking more about like the writing process?
Yeah, the writing process. Like,
am I going in the wrong direction?
No, you know what? It's both is good, because one thing we like to do is actually get into like the creative process of creating the thing, and also like the styles, like what kind of pencil work do you use and stuff.
That's okay. Okay.
People get really interested.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, I don't know if talking shop is really boring. The writing process on that was kind of strange, because I started it as a little short story for Oni Press Online, like their Sunday comics thing. I did I did sort of 4 or 5 weeks or something like that of a strip, and it was in the middle of the story, and actually some of that was taken out. I took some of that out. Then Brett Warnick and I at Top Shelf were talking about, you know, I wanted to make a little tiny book, and because I've seen Jordan Crane's Last Lonely Saturday, and mm-hmm. I loved the format of it. I thought it was really adorable, the little cute little size and the feel of it and everything. So I had this idea that I'd make this little tiny book, and we thought, oh, well, I have The Ticking from Oni Press. Oni said, yeah, sure, take it, you know, go do it with Top Shelf, whatever, and it turned out that it just grew and grew and grew into this more elaborate story, and so it just got out of hand. It just had a life of its own, just kind of like tentacles everywhere, and then I ended up paring it down, editing a lot of it out, throwing a lot of finished drawings away and stuff. So what's there now is a very, like, sort of pure form of the story. I took out tons of stuff that I'd had in there.
Wow. So how long did it take you to do this whole process?
A long time. Too long. Really, really too long. Yeah. Years, because I started it and... actually, I did a whole picture book for Simon & Schuster in between when I was working on it. So that kind of slowed it down, too. So I think it was 2.5 years or something like that. I might be completely off on that. It might have even been longer than that, but I think it was about 2 years.
I really like the illustrations that Edison does in the book. And, yeah, I was wondering, like, what it was like for you to get to draw those, because they're, like, kind of, they're consistent with your aesthetic, but they're different from your other drawings.
Yeah, what I did was, I had to force myself, because I tried making drawings for as him, right? I tried things like drawing with my other hand, but and stuff like that, but they all came out looking like my drawings. I mean, they were really like my drawings. So what I did was I decided to make copper plate etchings and do them dry point.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so then I went and like I paid money dues at a place where they had a printing press, and I went and, you know, did these prints, and I would sit there with a plate, and I would do the drawing on the plate, and because of the sort of working against the metal, it was a more forced line than I'm used to doing. So it just, and made it more simple. Like the line was, line work was simpler, and just didn't look like my own line work. And then I'd pull one print, and I remember getting these looks from the people who were there, because I'd have like three different plates, and I'd pull one and I'd get a good print, and they'd be waiting for me to pull more, like a whole edition, and I'd stop, and I'd have this one that was, and I looked at it, I thought, oh, that's good, that'll work to print, right? and then I'd go on to the next plate, and I'd pull one, and then stop. And these ladies were just like, these women who were hanging out there were just, you know, why aren't you making editions of those things? And because I just need one. Well, then why aren't you making monotypes? Because and they were disturbed by my subject matter. That was the other thing. And I'm putting it in the bath. The paper in the wash as well, in the and then I'd go and I'd pull the thing and I'd peel it off of the plate and the image would come up and these women were standing around and they were ready to go ooh or something, and you know, I'd pull it off and it's this toilet seat with pubic hair and stuff. And they're just kinda, you know, what is that? So
and they're like, ew, instead of
ew.
That's a pretty funny story. Well, I wish you had made more than one of each, because I actually think people would enjoy having their own for the wall.
I was really too lazy. Brett was talking about having, you know, maybe we could do a couple, you know, special editions of the print. And I thought, well, if I could get somebody to pull the prints for me, I'd be fine. But I'm just too lazy to do it myself, so it's just really labor. I mean, it's you know, inking it and then pulling it. Just kind of, and then my drawings are really take forever. You know, I mean, they're really labor intensive. But it's a different kind of thing, less messy.
That's funny you describe yourself as lazy, because that's like the most elaborate like thing I've ever heard anybody do to get like a different look to their own work. I don't think that's lazy.
I think
it's out of desperation though. I also did something really stupid, which was I couldn't get my handwriting for the book to be right the way I wanted it to look. So I lettered the whole thing upside down. The printing I did upside down, and then the handwriting, the script, I wrote backwards. So sort of backwards, and then flipped it over, and with a light box traced through the forward. Like I traced it through, so it was forwards. That's really stupid, but it made it look less like my handwriting and more like. More, I don't know, somehow more like a drawing. The handwriting looked more like a drawing to me that way.
I think that's really
sounds insane, but
no, it. You know what? I think that's neat, because talking to a lot of people, I'd say 90% of the artists I talk to live off of Photoshop.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it works well for a lot of people, but it can also take away from that. And I think that's something that really gives. Your work, like that, it does have a really organic feel to it.
Yeah, I can't stand. I have a real. It just gives me the heebie-jeebies. The thought of not having an original thing. Also, I like the feeling of the pencil on the paper. I like feeling the carbon come off onto the paper and stuff like that. I don't know what I'd do if I didn't. Have that, because it's actually the thing that I love about drawing is the feeling of doing it. It's more
that
than
smell of the pencil
thing. Yeah.
Yeah, the texture of the paper.
Yeah.
Yeah. I actually have always wondered about your work, how you get such even texture. Like, I imagine you're doing it on some kind of like watercolor paper that has a lot of surface texture.
It's not, if you saw it, you'd probably be surprised, because it's not as, the drawings are really small, first of all. I work at 100%, so they're not blown up, so the text, or they're not shrunk, I'm sorry, they're not reduced. So the texture you see is the texture, that's the texture of the drawing itself. And the tooth of the paper is really not, noticeable unless you put it up to a directional light. I mean, to directional light, you can see it, but it's not. Watercolor paper is too toothy. Mm. It's a very sort of cheap Canson drawing paper. That's just it's cold pressed, but it's not slick. You know, it's not shiny, but it's got a tooth, but it's more like that crappy kind of sketchbook paper that you find in a pad. It's more like that.
Like that kind of
than anything. It's not like the artsy paper. It's not it's not like arches or anything like that. Because that's too fabric-y for me. It's too soft, you know, too linen-y or something. I'm really specific about my paper, it's true, but it's not that toothy. Oh my God, I'm just going on like a maniac.
No, I actually find that kind of stuff really fascinating.
I did an interview with James Kolchak where we talked about brushes for 5 minutes.
No, my next
question. Yeah, which I find interesting that you talked about. I heard you. I heard that interview. I thought it was really interesting he talked about brushes so much when he's so... And I'm not picking a fight with him right now. I'm not having a go. I'm just...
it's on!
About his
process
craft thing.
The craft, yes. Craft is the enemy.
Yeah. I don't want to get into it.
Oh, yeah.
The debate.
Yeah.
Well,
no.
And because your work is so well crafted, too, I can only imagine that you may not exactly agree with that.
Yeah, I don't agree with him. I'm on the Jim Woodring side on that one.
That's so odd you should mention Jim Woodring, because I was wondering if he was one of your influences.
Yeah, yes, he is. I mean, when I first started, I hadn't, I didn't know about him. The people I saw before I started in comics were Chester Brown and Charles Burns and Julie. And I didn't discover Jim until after I'd already started, but yeah, for sure. I mean, I really relate to his work a lot. I mean, him and Dave Cooper, I think those are the two that you know, when I look at that stuff, I really just feel like we're speaking the same language.
Well, they do work that's beautifully creepy, too. Right?
Yeah, that's something I was going to say. There's a definite similarity, not in styles with Dave Cooper, but definitely bringing out beauty in ugliness.
Yeah.
Well, also with David Cooper, he gets into the psychology of things like you did with The Ticking as well.
Yeah, I really love Dave's stuff. I love what he does. I love his paintings and everything, too. I mean, it's not just the comics, but...
Yeah, I just shelled out for a print a couple months ago, so I'm on the same page.
I want to get something really big, put it in my studio.
Mine's about 3 inches wide.
<It's fine. laughs>
But I like it.
Just get close to it.
Yeah. No, he sent me some glossy cards with it that I framed, too. So those look just as nice up on the wall.
Behind me.
Watch out!
Then Julie yelled, "He's got a gun," and she shot rang out and I saw Julie falling. I ran to her and I held her close. When I looked down, my hands were red. And here's the last words Julie said.
Daddy, please don't. It wasn't his fault. He means so much to me. Daddy, please don't. We're gonna get
So I'm going to bridge to your schooling, your art education. Like, what was your impetus to get into art? And then what was the kind of your art schooling? Like, what kind of stuff did you take?
Well, I always was drawing, always. I mean, for as long as I can remember. But and actually, when I was little, I drew some really pornographic things that my mom found once. And actually, my little sister found them because they fell from my top bunk into her bottom bunk bed. And she gave them to my mom, and my mom sort of talked to me about it and eventually said, maybe someday you'll do medical illustration or something. Because I think she didn't want to scare me out of doing, you know, she didn't want to make a big issue out of it, which is a really good way to handle it, I think. And look how it turned out. Drawing pornographic things. But in high school, I mean, it's all I really thought about. I did well in school, but all I really wanted to do was stay in the art room all the time. And did a lot of photography, too. And then went to a small teacher's school called Kutztown University, which is in Pennsylvania, in Pennsylvania Dutch country, out in where there were all these horse and buggies and Amish people and stuff. And it was really quiet, and it had a really great faculty. And I met one of my teachers there, Harry Krizan, was an ex-student, I mean, an ex-classmate of Charles Burns. And he showed me Charles Burns' stuff. And that was kind of a big deal for me. He talked about, you know, you can make fine art and tell stories with it, and, you know, it can be in these books like this. And I think he was showing me Raw. I think that's what it was. I don't remember what it was, but I think that's what it was.
Do you still have a lot of the artwork he made when you were in school?
In college?
Or well, even from earlier than that, like from when you were a kid and stuff?
I think my mom has some. Mm-hmm. But most of it was pretty dark. I mean, I did a lot of... My mom didn't really want to save... I think she... a lot of that stuff was actually kind of disturbing, and I drew a lot of, like... creatures coming out of the ground and women, strange women holding these babies, you know, that were looked dead, and you know, I mean, it was like, it, you know, I mean, it was what you do when you're in high school, and I mean, when I was 5 years old, my mom signed me up for oil painting class with this woman down the street who was a retired Swedish actress who is now teaching oil painting. And so I did that, and I did all kinds of like landscapes and stuff like that I always knew I wanted to do it. I just didn't know what. So the seeing Charles Burns was a, I don't know, sort of opened my eyes to that storytelling thing.
You know, it's a good person to start out with.
Yeah, definitely.
There's some ongoing themes in your work, going through it. Reading The Ticking, reading Soap Lady. And also just read Worms in the Kramer's Ergot, number 4.
Oh, Worm.
That's a creepy one. Is his own bone he finds at the end?
Near her own finger.
What
finger,
was that?
Yeah. At the end of it, her own finger she finds on the beach or something?
Yes. Her finger bone.
She reclaims it.
Yeah, she reclaims it.
Yeah. Well, it's hers.
It's been pooped out by that thing. But it's still her finger bone.
Maybe she can get it reattached.
Reattached.
The ocean. I see it's a big thing that is ongoing in your work.
Oh, yeah. You noticed that.
What is it about the ocean that's so important?
Because
you're on the other side of it?
I'm looking at it right now. I guess for me, it's I love the water. I love the ocean, but it's scary too at the same time. I'm a little obsessed with it. I think I've got a bit of an obsession with the sort of old ships, and I can relate to Tony. I was just listening to Tony Millionaire. Your thing with Tony Millionaire, and I was just going, yeah, when he went off on this thing about ships and stuff, and there was this silence on the other end, and then there was this long pause, and he kind of was, oh, okay, I'll stop talking about ships.
No, we were into it.
And I was, you know, I was with him there.
I didn't know my stuff well enough to be able to respond. My dad would have been able to respond.
It's, I carry around this, like, 3D postcard of old ships. This, like, war scene of ships and stuff, and when I'm trying to relax, I kind of imagine, I just kind of think about being at the bottom of a ship with the squeak, you know, with the all the squeaking, the creaking of the wood, and the, I don't know what it is. It's like this, I'm terrified, though, at the same time, of underwater, you know. I like being on a boat, I like being around water, I like seeing the ocean and islands and stuff. But scuba diving, for example, really sort of scares me. That you don't know what's down there really scares me. There could be gigantic, scary things down there. You just don't know.
Like giant squids.
Yes, the giant squids.
Yeah, that's right.
Like for Ben Catmull stuff, you know, with the, you know, he's sort of obsessed with those sea lion things, those manatees and stuff. But anyway, it's a scary thing, and at the same time, it's a beautiful thing. It makes me really relaxed. When I'm around the ocean, I feel really relaxed. But yeah, it shows up, and it's gonna show up again in the book I'm doing now. So,
well, let's hear about your next piece of work.
I've got three things. We're putting together two books of things that sort of exist already, not completely, but that do. For the most part, Micrographica, which is an online thing that I was doing for Serializer, which is completely different. It's these little drawings that I made that are like a centimeter square, tiny little drawings of a story about these rodents that are they're by the water actually, but they're, you can't see the water.
it's about, your thoughts it's there.
I know it's there. They're on Hunter's Hill, which is in Sydney, and it's about them and their poop balls and how they love their balls of poop, and it's just sort of weird and slapsticky and goofy.
Yeah,
Top Shelf's going to put that out. It's going to be a little book. It'll be out for Ape or San Diego next year. And then we have a book of drawings of girls and rabbits that have appeared in gallery shows that Sparkplug is putting together. And then I'm working on this huge project called Toaster Lodge, which is spelled T-O-W-C-E-S-T-E-R. It's Tau Sister, and it's about a hotel in Scotland where I was working on a project drawing the place, pretty much, and what happened during the process of that, so it's sort of in journal form with lots of drawings and some of my photography and, you know, stuff like that. But there's water there, it's by a lake, it's not ocean.
Well, they have Loch Ness there, so in Scotland, don't they? That's a big lake. The Loch Ness. It's a big lake.
Yes. Well, it's like that. This is by a loch, but it's not Loch Ness. Different loch.
Loch Ness. Now you live in Australia now.
Half time.
That's an odd scenario.
Is it?
That's an extreme commute. Australia for 6 months, and then was it L.A. you're saying for the other six?
No, near outside of San Francisco.
Oh, okay.
Actually, the what's called the Bay Area, I guess Silicon Valley, actually. I grew up on the East Coast, so I'm not. I mean, you know, I'm more. I miss New York a lot. And Sydney's kind of my New York now. And the Silicon Valley is I don't know. It's just I don't actually feel really comfortable there. But we went out there because of work. My husband got a different job, so we moved out to California.
Work.
Yes, work.
The evil necessity in life.
Yes. And so he works in the Sydney office half time, and the one there half time. So we go back and forth. But Sydney, we've been coming to Sydney for about 10 years on and off. So, yeah,
lovely.
This feels more like home, actually.
One day I'm supposed to go to, is it Brisbane?
Yeah, where Eddie Campbell is.
I guess. Yes, that is where he is. Apparently, my family's inherited land in Nananagoo, it's called, or something like that. I'll never pronounce it properly. Rabbits.
Bunnies.
Your love of rabbits. Your book of rabbits. I listened to that quick little thing in that podcast you sent me the link for from the Australian.
An Australian radio. I was talking about bunnies.
It was odd. I was listening to it and they're using I don't know if you're familiar with Coil, this weird English experimental band. They're using their music and it was.
Were they?
Yeah.
I didn't know what the music was, but there was a lot of overproducing, I think, on that thing.
I got kind of lost for a little bit. So
I know. Yeah.
What's with the rabbits? Why the
what's
love
the
of
rabbits?
Rabbits?
I grew up with them. I mean, we had a lot of them when I was a little kid, and you know, we kept getting them as they died. We just kept getting more. We always it was sort of the pet we had. And, I mean, I don't know, they're I just love their faces, and I think, it's not as symbolic as people think, or at least it's not intentionally that way. I mean, it's not that they're, you know, some kind of sinister symbol or something like that. I just think they're really cute, that's all. And they're sort of the thing I come back to because I had so many rabbits when I was a kid.
And they're banned as pets in Australia or something? Was that
they were one of the things that that they brought in here that they shouldn't have, that sort of got out of control. That they imported bunnies and then they were out there and they just multiplied and nothing was eating them. They don't have any
predators.
Anything eating them. Yeah, no, there are no predators to get rid of them. So
it's like
they're just
the
there
Simpsons
are just
episode
of them,
with
you know,
the frogs.
Where they just take over.
Yeah.
Another theme I see sticking out is isolation. It seems like all the main characters kind of are very lonesome.
Yeah, so sad.
Is that something when creating like children's books, is you try to create something for kids because a lot of kids can feel isolated and just kind of giving something to identify with?
It is sort of when the first kids book I did, mainstream kids book I did was about a little sheep that was, you know, so small that she was made fun of, and she was all by herself and stuff. And she has to sleep by herself, which is the thing. Yeah, And so in the end, you know, she finds out that she really likes having her own bedroom and stuff. I mean, it's that classic story of when you're a kid being afraid to sleep by yourself thing. Yeah, I think it works really well as a kid's book story because, I guess I was lonely when I was a kid, and I think all kids feel that. So, it runs across my adult stuff, too. And I really like being alone. I'm one of those people who, I know a lot of people who need to be surrounded by people all the time, and I'm really not like that. I like to be by myself a lot. So I don't know if it's ironic that my stories are about loneliness, a lot of them, or if it just makes sense. I don't know. That's just where I go, though. It's not that thought out.
Treat me like a fool, treat me mean and cruel, but love me. Bring my faithful heart, tear it all apart, but love me.
Won't you love me?
Darling, I'll be oh so lonely. I'll be sad and blue, crying over you, dear only. I would beg and steal,
beg and steal,
just to feel your heart.
I want your heart
beating close to mine,
so close to mine.
Wherever you ever go, darling, I'll be sad and blue, crying over you, dear only. I would beg and steal,
he would beg and steal,
just to feel,
yes, just to feel
your heart. Go, darling, I'll be oh so lonely, begging on my knees. All I ask is please, please love me. Oh, yes.
What are some... Yeah, no, it does. What are some outside influences other than comics in your work?
Well, comics aren't really that... I mean, I have to say that I'm not really that influenced by comics generally. I mean, I don't want to be influenced by comics, really, because to me that sort of feels like swiping more than it. I mean, it's kind of like I'd rather not be influenced at all by another cartoonist. I'd rather be influenced by someone in another field, just because I don't know, just that much more removed. But I'm mostly, I think, influenced by films more than anything. There's David Lynch, but Cronenberg and. Night of the Hunter, a lot of those sort of, I like Polanski, those guys. Nobody really specifically, but that sort of aesthetic,
kind of dark,
really
cerebral.
Appeals to me.
kind of dark, cerebral.
Yeah, just something that sticks with you that you can watch. I mean, the movies that I watch over and over again, like a zillion times over and over again, are more like Cool Hand Luke and The Great Escape and stuff like that. I watch those just, you know, I've seen them a zillion times.
Okay.
And they're not really like that much, but yeah.
So are you also interested in strange medical anomalies and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, that stuff, yes. I mean, I really like old... More than that, I like the tools and the old medical procedures more than the, you know, the sort of, like, two-headed fetus kind of thing. I'm not that much into the carnival freak show kind of stuff. I mean, I find that stuff interesting, but I'm not, that's not really where I go on that stuff. I'm more kind of interested in the, like, ancient medical practices and stuff like that. Not, you know, old lobotomy tools and how they used to do the procedures and that stuff I find more interesting.
I'm just wondering because at the end of the soap lady, there's that little blurb about the old body that was found that had kind of turned into a sort of soap. I guess that was the inspiration or the nugget for the book, like the idea.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I lived in Philadelphia for 8 years, and I worked in an office building, and then I would, there was a place in Philadelphia that everyone, if anyone is ever in Philadelphia, they should check out this place. It's called the Mutter Museum, M-U-T-T-E-R, and it's the Museum of Medical Science there. They have an amazing, just they have an amazing collection of stuff there. They have... this entire cabinet. I actually did a piece for the Gonsfeld, one of the Gonsfelds. They have an entire cabinet of objects that were taken out of children and adults' respiratory, you know, their lungs or their stomachs. They were extracted with the scope that was created by Dr. Chevalier Jackson, and he collected all of these objects. So they're like little trains and whistles and beans and like all kinds of things that were taken out, and then little piece of paper that says what happened to the patient. Did the patient die or did the patient survive, and what happened? And I used to hang out there a lot at this place, and there was this woman on display, a body of a woman on display who had died in the 1800s of something. I'm not sure what she died of, and she was obese when she died, and so when she was decomposing, the fat in her body and the ammonia from the decomposition, they created the what happened was she turned into this soap-like substance and mummified that way, so she was preserved that way. So she's terrifying looking, like she has this sort of, like her jaw is open and she's just scary, but she was preserved like that, and she's pretty much soap. I mean, compositionally, she's made out of soap now. So I thought it would be funny as a joke to sort of send a kid's book idea to Eric Reynolds at Fantagraphics, like, you know, and I made it really scary, like she would take off her arm and wash out a kid's mouth with it, you know, if he said bad words, or you know, lop off pieces of her body and give it to the kids at night, middle of the night, she walked the streets.
Well, and then she does, but it's funny hearing you tell that story, because it's like all, oh, the body's so disturbing and stuff, and then you made the soap lady, and she's actually like... Like, the image of her is sort of scary and disturbing, but then as the book goes on, like, you're very endeared to her, and she has this really good friendship with the little boy, so it's kind of ironic.
Yeah.
She ends up...
I mean, it turned it... Well, I'm sorry. I mean, when I first thought that it was funny, it was really scary, but then when I went to Top Shelf with it, it was... I'd kind of like fallen in love with her as this sweet character, you know, and and why does she have to be bad just because she's freakish looking like that? So yeah,
she
and,
helps tr-
and I mean the kids, that's another example of the the parents sort of freaking out at the image of this thing, where the kids don't, they're not scared of her at all. The kids who read that book think, you know, they like her. That she's, you know, there's nothing scary about her. She's, but parents think she's scary.
And the parents in the book thought she was scary too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It, I mean, it is the point of the story, and it's proven again and again to me when I see a parent holding the book and, oh, she's really disturbing. But the kids never react like that. I've never seen a kid react like that to the drawings of the soap lady.
Well, kids don't have the taboos that in yet.
No, they don't. They
God
don't.
Bless.
They don't see her that way. I mean, she's very sort of sweet-looking if you take away the, you know, strangeness of her. She kind of looks like a weird bird or something. I mean, I know she's kind of skull-like, but at the same time, she has this very maternal sort of round body, you know, like a grandmother,
mm-hmm.
kind of. Yeah.
I think we're
If I'd done it for Simon and Schuster, they never let me get away with like having her butt, like butt cheeks or anything. I mean, they would. Oh, she can't have a
she can't have
a butt crack or anything. Oh no, you know, what'll we do?
Well, then it's no wonder you get frustrated with them doing those children's books.
Right now, I'm so turned off by it. After my experience with the last one I did, I don't know if I'm going back to it. I've just, they ended up sort of pushing me into changing the title of the second book I did for them in the end, because it was too scary, the title that I had come up with, which was Woolly Man. Ooh, itchy, no, woolly. So... watch out, he's woolly. So so we had to change the title because they pretty much said if we don't change the title, the marketing people aren't going to get behind it. I mean, that's pretty much what they
boo.
Well, did you change it?
They never actually came out and said that, but you know.
Or like fuzzy furry man. Soft cuddly man.
I'm creeped out by fuzzy furry man.
He doesn't have a face, though. I mean, he doesn't. The main doll in the story, the Woolly Man doll, doesn't have a face. He has stitches down the front. I mean, he himself is kind of, you know, and he's on the cover. It was the title that they didn't. It was really bizarre. I don't know. Well, don't get me started on that because I'll just be all like, mad and stuff. You know.
Well,
I'm wondering, like, if it was a Canadian company or if it was. Oh, you guys are kind of. You're kind of conservative in a way, though.
Kind of right now, but we have a conservative government, but it's a minority government.
Well, it depends on which Canadian you're talking to.
Where, like, where we are, it's, like, you know, I'd say probably similar to San Francisco or something like that, very liberal. Even a liberal is a bad term in BC because the Liberal Party is actually extremely right-wing.
Yeah.
When you say you're liberal, you mean you're, like, you know, goose-stepping...
It's like you're a Canadian Republican or liberal,
So, we're the New Democrats, whatever that means.
The New Democrats?
That's our leftist contingency party.
I think when I did Gritbath, it was one of the places it was banned was Canada, where it was seized at the border.
Well, the border is something
different.
The border
is notorious for doing things like that. And I think they do it more just to, like, make the retailers aggravated more than, like, it's sort of a form of harassment.
Well, there's this one time where the owner of Little Sisters, one of our local gay, lesbian, yada, yada, yada bookstores, ordered the same books as someone who ordered Duthies, like
no,
their friend.
Duthies ordered, like,
they ordered the exact
Little
same.
Little Sisters couldn't get the books across the border, so Duthies ordered the same books and had no problem getting them. And it depends on, like, who the border guard is that day. And
I was able to buy Lost Girls at my local comic store, but I can't
order. You were. I was wondering about that.
I was surprised I was told it wouldn't be coming up here for a long time, and then I got it at the comic store, and then I tried to order the special artist proof edition and got an email.
That's a good sign.
Yeah, but I got an email saying I couldn't order the artist proof edition, so I cried a little on the inside.
You can only go too far.
Yeah. I want to thank you for coming on today. We're nearing the end of our time, allotted time that we're going to be
using. Well, thanks for having me on.
It was a pleasure. I look forward to more work coming up by you, and one day maybe meeting you at a convention.
I hope you're not
something.
Too tired. I know it's really late there.
it's about almost one, but I don't work right now. I don't actually do anything right now except for the show. My co-host for the evening is a worker, but she doesn't.
But I'm routinely up this late, if not later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a good time for me.
It's a fun change and stuff. It's really quiet at the station here right now, so. I wish you luck on the Ignatz nominations. I know it's your
name. Thank you. I don't think I have a chance, but thanks.
You never know.
Well, you're nominated.
I'm up against biggies.
So by definition, you have a chance.
Someone's got to.
If you're nominated, by definition, you have a chance, right?
And someone's got to beat out that Chris Ware guy.
I see.
Someone's got to beat out that Chris Ware guy sometime.
Who?
I know. I think I would probably vote for Anders.
Yeah.
I'm going to vote for someone.
Listen to our my show last week. He was
Anders was on.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm a huge fan.
Yeah, no, he's I'm looking forward to his next
book.
So many good comics out there. So little money. I spent too much. Thank you very much, Renee, for coming on.
Thank you, too, Robbins. And say hi to Colin for me, by the way.
I will. He's probably asleep right now.
Yeah, I know. It's probably about his bedtime.
Or he's probably making mini comics. It's our big thing this weekend in town.
Or drinking tea.
I think he was in the same batch of comics that got canceled at Fantagraphics the same time as mine.
Oh, probably.
I think so.
He doesn't talk about it much.
No.
He's a mopey one.
No, too depressing, yeah.
Yeah, so. Okay, thank you, and have a good
day.
Thank
you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Renee French, creator of The Ticking and Soap Lady. And, wow, her stuff is great. I really recommend checking out. It's really unique, just such fine penciling work. I really look forward to more work by her. And I think you should check it out, too. Top Shelf is her main publisher, www.topshelfcomics.com. This has been the Inkstead Show. I was joined by Robin Kay. Say goodbye, Robin.
Goodbye, Robin.
Yay. Mm. Now I'll press stop.
Well, we would like to... I'd like to do a couple of love songs here for you. Now, one, you know, the man's best friend is his dog, if he's got nothing else. And this song is about a dog. Well, he's not very handsome to look at. Oh, he's shaggy and he eats like a hog. And he's always killing my chickens, that dirty old egg-sucking dog. Egg-sucking dog, I'm gonna stomp your head in the ground if you don't stay out of my hen house. You dirty old egg-sucking hound. Now if he don't stop eating my eggs up, though I'm not a real bad guy, I'm going to get my rifle and send him to that great chicken house in the sky.